This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we try really, really hard not to mention that airframer that seems to have filled the last number of episodes with topics. And I think we did pretty well. But we do talk about some of the news from the past week. We talk about Strato Launch's development of hypersonic air vehicles. We talk about China's C-929 widebody passenger jet that's in development. Also, stealing from Air Force One. The Gulfstream G700 gets certification. Spirit Airlines gets a credit boost from an interesting source. A panel recommends an end to pilot disclosure of therapy sessions. United Airlines asks pilots to stay home. And Frontier Airlines has a little fun. All that and more, it's coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 793 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is first our main man, Micah.
Hey, great to be here. Very exciting to not be talking about a company that shall go unnamed.
That's right. We're going to try to get through the whole thing without mentioning that particular airframer. There's one story that we might get a little close, but I think we can do it without mentioning them. Give us all a little breather from that. Also with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian. He's from the American Helicopter Museum.
Well, guys, I got to tell you.
Yes?
After the last couple of weeks, I've decided I'm leaving the show.
No.
I just can't do it anymore, so I'm going to leave the show.
If we promise not to talk about that particular airframer, would that change your mind?
I don't think it's going to change my mind. But keep in mind, folks, that we are recording this on April 1st.
Thank you, David. And he did it with a straight face, too. Absolutely. Well, also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a National CFI of the Year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Hey, hello everyone from Chicago. Oh, wait a minute.
So Rob
is not here with us tonight, so he asked me to pitch hit for him. So if you hear any wisecracks or stuff like that, that'll be me filling in for Rob. No, I'm sorry, he won't be able to join us. But anyway, I'm happy to be here with the gang.
Terrific. All right, last episode I think I said that we had a guest this episode, but I was actually mistaken.
And we April Fools.
Yeah, April Fools. Oh, yeah, I should have.
All right. So long. See you next week.
I should have done that. Yeah, yeah. But we do have one for next week, if I remember correctly. So we're going to launch right into the aviation news from the past week. First item comes from The Aviationist. This is Strato Launch unveils Talon A2, its fully recoverable and reusable hypersonic vehicle. Max T, this is pretty cool. I love this kind of stuff.
This is pretty wild, but I have to say I'm not particularly familiar with it. So why don't you go ahead and launch in it, because you probably know more about it than I do.
Well, this is about Strato Launch. Now, you may recall Strato Launch was formed in 2011 by Paul Allen of Microsoft, co-founder, and Bert Rutan from Scaled Composites. And they built this giant six-engine twin fuselage carrier aircraft. The idea was that you would sort of sling a payload launch vehicle underneath the plane between these two fuselages. And then you'd fly up to high altitude, release this thing, which would then fire off and deliver the payload into orbit, into space. So you could call it an air-launched space transportation system. Well, it didn't get too far. The plane was built. The Strato-Launch plane was built that I guess is nicknamed ROC, R-O-C. And then Paul Allen passed away in 2018. The company was acquired in 2019 by Cerebus Capital Management. So it's a privately held company now. But they are working on advancing hypersonic technology, and they've built this Talon A, which is an autonomous reusable testbed, they call it. The first version of this, the TA-1, flew not too long ago on March 9th, 2024. It was released from the Strato launch, didn't quite reach hypersonic speed. I don't think it was supposed to on this first flight. And now Stratolaunch has shown us photos of the TA-2, which is a new version that is designed to be reusable. They plan to land it at Vandenberg Space Force Base and then reuse it. So, I mean, there are several different hypersonic programs out there, some military, some maybe non-military as well. But when you see the picture of the Stratolaunch aircraft, you will remember it. It almost, it looks like two giant airliners joined together with these six jet engines. As I recall, I think they use early Pratt & Whitney 747 engines, as I recall. I probably should have checked that out.
And the fuselages are B-52s.
Ah, that's right. The thing is enormous. I mean, just spectacularly enormous. It looks fragile because of the separation of these two fuselages, at least to me. But I know, I mean, this comes from scaled composites. So, you don't have to worry about that kind of thing, despite how it might look. So it's interesting. They're marching along with this.
So, Max, how do you power a hypersonic aircraft?
So hypersonic means greater than Mach 5 in the atmosphere. So it doesn't include rockets and, orbital devices or whatever. In the atmosphere, greater than Mach 5, that's hypersonic. So how you get to hypersonic speed, there's a lot of different ways that it's done. Oftentimes scramjets. Sometimes with a rocket motor. I mean, an example of that is, you can go back in time, the X-15, right? That was rocket-powered. That was hypersonic, faster than Mach 5. Rocket engines are also used sometimes. Also, there's some work going on concerning a rotating detonation engine. So there's lots of ways that you can do it. And there are other hypersonic aircraft out there. I mentioned the X-15. What else, David? Things like the X-43 that had a booster rocket and then maintained speed with a scramjet.
Yeah, I mean, it's a technology that is – the engines is difficult. The SR-71 was 3+, and Machs go up exponentially, so it's hard. And a ramjet probably is the most efficient way of doing it. But you need to be able to get a ramjet up to speed for it to work. A ramjet, of course, Max, correct me if I'm wrong, is basically just injecting fuel into a lit container and just raw. It's a giant afterburner.
Yeah, essentially the inlet air, you don't have a compressor. You, because of the speed of the vehicle and the shape of the of that container you're talking about, David, the air compresses basically on its own, and then you dump fuel in it and light it and off you go. Ramjets typically, the airflow is subsonic. With scramjets, the airflow is supersonic. And so most of these things are air-launched. You put them under the wing of a B-52 or something, or a Stratolaunch aircraft, fly up to altitude, build up some speed, then drop it. I don't think there are any hypersonic vehicles that can take off from a runway, fly up, reach supersonic speed on their own. I think they're all airdropped or use some other method to accelerate them up to speed. So cool stuff. I guess it's nice to see that the Strato launch has a purpose, because for a number of years there, I think it just sort of sat in the hangar and not much was happening. Now, I did read something that suggests that the company, Strato Launch, the company may be headed towards a different kind of carrier vehicle in the future. So I don't know if the Rock has a long-term future ahead of it, at least in terms of doing this kind of work. But, you know, we'll watch that because it's fascinating stuff.
So the question I've got is, it says that the Talon A can carry payloads up to 1,000 pounds. When you're zipping along at Mach 5, how do you deploy a payload? I mean, it seems like it would get destroyed in the process. Or do you think that, you know, the Talon is just going to remain in orbit? What do you think the actual use case is for these Talons that are being dropped from the Rock?
You know, probably military. But, I'm just speculating.
It's too bad because I was planning to buy tickets for the first one. Yeah, of course. No, I agree. Probably military.
But it also could be, I mean, if you're going to look at it this way, as an experimental aircraft, you could have 1,000 pounds of experimental test sensors, et cetera, that requires speed. I mean, I think that's really where it's going, is all of the equipment that you need to monitor it and eventually make a production aircraft of it would be all of the sensor equipment.
Yeah, interesting. And of course, when people talk about or think about hypersonic, you know, people pretty quickly go to commercial aircraft. They're going to zip you transcontinental or between continents in an unbelievably short amount of time. But I think, in my opinion, we are so far away from that, if ever. A lot of technology needs to be developed to allow something like that.
We're still working on supersonic travel, let alone hypersonic travel. We talked about Boom last week.
Right, right. So, you know, 50 years, maybe, for something hypersonic, if we're even moving ourselves around physically that way.
Are you sure it's not, you know, within the next decade, like fusion power and hydrogen powered zeppelins?
Yeah, right on the heels of that. All right, next item. This is in Channel News Asia. China's homegrown C929 widebody passenger jet enters, quote, crucial development stage amid Beijing's aviation push. You know, when you think about China's commercial aviation strategy, it's pretty obvious to me. It's pretty direct. They start out with the ARJ-21, a regional jet, you know, a smaller regional jet, followed by the C919, larger commercial jet, sort of in the 737/A320 class. And then that's followed by the C929, which is what this is about, which is a wide-body commercial jet. So you can see what they're doing. They're, you know, starting small and taking steps, and it's, I think, a very directed strategy. The weak point of it in terms of getting to a fully indigenous Chinese airliner is the engine technology. They don't have the engine technology for that. In fact, the ARJ-21, the regional jet, that uses basically GE CF-34 engines, which if you know business aviation jets, there's a lot of aircraft that use the CF-34, you know, very reliable, you know, business jet class kind of an engine. And in fact, for the C919, that uses the CFM LEAP 1C. So basically the same, or a variant of the CFM engine that you find on a 737 MAX or a, you notice I didn't use the B word, 737 MAX or an A320 family.
And the ARJ-21 was very much, fuselage-wise, was very much based on the MD-90 program, because Shanghai was working on a lot of the tooling for the MD-90 at the time, and that's where they started building the ARJ-21, was in that tooling factory.
And it definitely looks a lot like the MD-90 or the MD-80, you know, both. Yeah, as you mentioned, produced under license in China. Now, COMAC, which is the Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China, COMAC. COMAC is the builder of these. COMAC says that, no, it's a completely indigenous design. It doesn't have anything to do with the MD-80 or the MD-90. Okay, maybe yes, maybe no. But they've delivered, let's see, at the end of 2022 anyway, they delivered 100 of the ARJ-21s, largely for Chinese customers. The C919, the A320/737 class aircraft, launched with China Eastern Airlines in 2022, the end of 2022. And I believe 5 of those aircraft have been delivered so far, all of them to China Eastern. But they have orders for over 1,000 of these things. A lot of them in China, almost all in China. Either China Eastern, I think, has 100 more on order. There's some leasing companies in China that have you know, scads of these on order. But there are a few others, a couple, outside of China. And that's always the big, you know, the big issue with the Chinese aviation strategy, commercial aviation strategy is, okay, you've got kind of a captive audience in China, and the way it works, or at least the way it used to work, probably still does, is that the many airlines in China don't have complete control over their orders for aircraft. Various, you know, government components tell them how many they're going to purchase of which models and so forth. So it is kind of a captive market. But so the thing is, okay, so what about getting outside of China where they can really compete with the major airframers? That's what they ultimately want to do. Certification is a real, you know, is a real issue, as is acceptance on the part of the operators around the world for a Chinese aircraft. So we'll see.
When Brian and I were at Farnborough 100 years ago now, I think it was back in 2016, there was an interior mock-up of the C919. And someplace I probably have a picture of myself in it that Brian took, but it would look very comfortable, you know, very modern. It was really, really beautiful. And, you know, here it is, ready to fly now.
Yes. And one last point on the C929, the wide body, is that initially Russia was partnered with China on this aircraft and was to supply the engines for the C929. But lately, I don't know, it seems like Russia may have lost interest or is disengaging from that a little bit. The Russian company that was to be involved in this is the United Aircraft Corporation, UAC, is what they called it, and they were going to be involved in that. But it really does seem like they've dropped out of the program. But I don't know, that may change. And then, of course, the engines would be a real issue because China just cannot currently design or manufacture engines of this class. All right, shifting gears a little bit. This is kind of a fun story, Micah, from Politico. What are they saying about – this is about Air Force One.
Yeah, I read it, and I just started thinking that, you know, a lot of people have issues trusting the reporters of the White House, and this just shows once again that you just got to be careful with your trust. But, you know, getting to ride on – there's a reporter group, you know, White House reporters that fly with Air Force One and are part of the presidential team in some ways, and they fly in the back of Air Force One. But apparently, there's been a lot of pilfering going on. People have been taking dishes and glasses and pillows and towels, and it's sort of been let go for a long time. But now, the Air Force is sort of starting to collect and not prosecute people, but have said things like, you know, let us know if you have it. We'll collect it. No questions asked. And it's been a real issue.
They're walking off with anything with the Air Force One insignia, basically. And like you say, I mean, some of this stuff is is significant. It's not like, you know, swiping a spoon from an airline or something like that. But, you know, when I was looking at this, I'm thinking, all right, if I was on Air Force One, if I was in the press corps and I got to ride on Air Force One, how could you resist? I mean, I would, you know, that tumbler, that glass, that whatever it was. I mean, what a cool memento. I'd be really hard pressed to leave everything there.
But the Air Force and the Marines have stuff to give away with those logos. There is a list of souvenirs that are purposely stashed aboard the airplane, like decks of cards and other things. I know this from doing the presidency in the helicopter. Is over the years, Marine One, there are things that you can take away that have the logos. You know, at one point, Ronald Reagan had Marine One jelly bean holders filled with jelly beans, you know, and now they're on the aftermarket, but they were given away to the people who were on the aircraft. There is no reason to steal a towel. If you ask for some, they will be happy to give you something, you know. And my uncle, who used to go around the world flying, and there's a reason why I have a huge collection of silverware with various airline logos on it, was if the airline didn't want you to take it, they wouldn't put the logo on it, you know. But that being said, I mean, there's a lot of – some of the stuff I was hearing being taken is sort of really absurd. It's like, okay, really? You needed that whatever, that blanket that you got?
Hey, I need to keep warm. I mean, if it's got a Air Force One logo on it, how cool? I'd be the only, you know, the only dope in the neighborhood with one.
This is really what really excited me. You know, several colleagues of one former White House correspondent for a major newspaper described them hosting a dinner party where all the food was served on gold rim Air Force One plates, evidently taken bit by bit over the course of time. Reporters recalled coming down the back stairs after returning to the Joint Base Andrews in the evening with the sounds of clinking glassware or porcelain plates in their backpacks. That's a bit much.
That's over the top. So who gets to fly on Air Force One? Besides the president, obviously.
Well, there are three groups, basically, is what it comes down to. I did a little research on this earlier before the show, and there's three categories. There's the military and civilian crew, you know, pilots and flight attendants who are assigned to the aircraft. They're chosen, you know, regular duty rosters. And obviously people can request that assignment or apply for it. Then there's the president and his staff. It's Secret Service and White House staffers and advisors who are, you know, picked based on the need of the trip. Could be the white, include the White House press corps that does travel with Air Force One in the rear of the cabin and the mobile press room. And then there are guests that the president invites. Could be personal guests or congressional staff, but that's it. And it looks like, based on this article, even senators were not beyond taking everything that weren't bolted down at different times.
Doesn't surprise me.
So, but when I saw this story, I said, yeah, this is fun. This is a perfect story. And even though it's April Fool's Day, this is not April Fool's.
No, it's not a joke.
No, this is very believable. But I thought it was an interesting comment about they wouldn't want you to take it if they didn't put the logo on. Think about if all of this silverware had no logos on. You're right. Nobody would take this stuff. Nobody would care.
Yeah.
But the press wranglers for Air Force One had sent out notes and emails, and it's quoted here in the article. It says, hey, if you inadvertently wound up taking something off the plane by mistake, we can help facilitate a quiet return, which I just thought was hysterical.
All right, in AvWeb, this is talking about the Gulfstream G700, has received certification, FAA certification. This is a big jet, Micah.
It is very big, and it is very fast, and it has great range. I mean, this is one reason that I wish Rob were here, because he loves business jets, and he knows them so much better than I do. But, yeah, it has a 7,750 nautical mile range at Mach 0.85. But the best part about it, reminds me of the 787 is that it holds an altitude, in cabin altitude, of 2,840 feet while flying at 41,000 feet. That's unbelievable.
That's a really low cabin.
That's so nice. That makes such a big difference if you're out there for a long time. Because if you got a cabin altitude of 6 or even 7,000 feet, man, you start to get a little dull and groggy and whatever. So yeah, this is fabulous.
Yeah, you know, and Brian and I talk about that all the time, flying the 7-8, because, you know, because it's a composite fuselage, the cabin altitude is lower than what it is on other aircraft, and you truly feel a difference with jet lag. And this is like, you know, this is like being in Pennsylvania. I mean, it's not even like being in Colorado. It's practically sea level.
Well, it's also pretty fast, too. I was talking with someone recently about the Boeing business jet, and they said, it's kind of slow. It's only about 0.76 knot Mach, I think is what they said. This is 0.85. So, yeah, for people wanting to get where they're going, it certainly gets you there faster.
And it's propelled by some Rolls-Royce Pearl 700 engines, which are derived from the sort of venerable BR-725. They call these the Pearl 700 engines. They put out about, that depends on which one, but around 18,000 pounds of thrust each. So they're pretty beefy. And it's not an inexpensive aircraft by any means. And sales, I mean, they seem to be pretty good. AppWeb reports that AeroTime says that Gulfstream expects to deliver about 50 G700s in 2024 and about 160 jets overall across all the Gulfstream types. That, again, in 2024. I don't know what the history, the delivery history is, what the rate has been past years. That'd be interesting to see how it's trending. But 50 of these things, I think these are, what are these, 75 million a copy kinds of jets, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah, that's about what I would guess. You know, the interesting thing is we often talk about what the purchase price is, but you don't really think about what's the operating cost. I was talking with someone recently that manages a Global, which is, you know, in this class of aircraft, and just leaving that thing sitting on the ground, not flying, doing nothing, I think he said was $2.4 million a year. That's just the cost, you know, to let it sit there on the ground. Pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, wow.
And well, you know, I didn't really pay attention to that because I did not win the $1 billion megabucks ticket, so mega millions.
I didn't either. That's why I was surprised it was so expensive. I should have known, right, if I had
That's
one.
Right.
But I think that included aircraft pilot salaries as well. But that's a tiny part of the $2.4 million.
You know what they say, if you have to ask.
All right. Spirit Airlines is in the news. Of course, they've been in the news concerning the failed, I guess you'd call it, merger with JetBlue in their financial situation. And also they are experiencing unscheduled engine removals and inspections that for certain Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engines. These are the ones that are victim of that contaminated powder metal problem. So with its A320neo aircraft, Spirit is actually the largest operator of that engine in the U.S. And taking those aircraft out of service, well, that has a huge financial impact. Other airlines are impacted by this all as well. So it seems that a deal has been struck, and Spirit is going to get compensation, get a monthly credit through the end of this year, 2024. For unavailability of their aircraft when they're taken out of service for this inspection. And Spirit says that this will boost their liquidity by between $150 million and $200 million, which is something that Spirit could really use.
Max, I was curious about this because we talk about it being Pratt & Whitney in the geared turbofan, but it talks about this is actually going through a company called International Aero Engines, which is a conglomerate of several companies. And I had a question about how Pratt & Whitney got involved with this, because I remember when we first on the Geeks over a decade ago, talked about the geared turbofan. We had a guest from Pratt & Whitney on. This was a Pratt & Whitney product. It was only going to be offered by Pratt & Whitney. So where did International Aero Engines come from, and what's Pratt & Whitney's responsibility versus this sub-corporation?
So International Aero Engines, or IAE, was a, well, it is a joint venture, but it was formed in the 80s to produce an engine for the 150-seat single-aisle aircraft market. And the result of that was the V2500 engine, which is, you know, finds itself on a number of different aircraft. And there were originally five participants in this joint venture, but Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce were the major equity, I guess, equity holders in this. There were others that were, MTU was in there, and Japan was in there. And that's how it operated. Now, subsequently, Pratt & Whitney bought out Rolls-Royce on this. I think that, these kind of joint ventures, you do see when there is some risk to developing an engine for a particular application, and no one company is comfortable shouldering all of the risk. So it's really kind of a risk-sharing arrangement. Of course, you're sharing profit as well, but the downside is limited by that arrangement. The same with Pratt & Whitney and GE on the A380 engine. They also collaborated on that. So the V2500 engine, it's on the A320 CEO family, not the NEO family. It's also used on the Embraer KC390, and on the, it was used on the MD90s as well. So they're not producing new engines anymore. They're they're involved in the aftermarket support. I think that's what the company is mostly about. Okay, so that's the history. So that doesn't answer your question, Mike, which is okay. So here's this Pratt & Whitney engine that had this problem. Some of them with the contaminated powdered metal and needing removals and inspections. So how does IAE get involved in this? I mean, even the headline of the article from CNBC is Spirit Airlines gets credit from International Aero Engines. I don't know. I'm really not sure. The only thing I can think of is that it's some kind of financial arrangement that lets this money flow through, you know, that portion of what's now RTX, of which Pratt & Whitney's a part. I don't know. I hope somebody can explain it. I tried to look around to see if there was an explanation and haven't been able to find one. This is something that John Ostrower would probably be able to help us with. So I'm watching my the Air Current subscription to see if he addresses it. But it's just very strange. I'm not able to explain it. But I gave you the history anyway.
No, that's good, because if you're not able to explain it, then, you know, then I'm not crazy asking the questions.
No, it's a good question. Max Trescott, so this next item is kind of an interesting topic, and it has to deal with pilots and having to disclose talk therapy sessions that they're undergoing. What are we seeing happening here?
Yeah, so if we go back in history a little bit, this has always been a large issue for pilots, especially pilots who are employed and depend upon flying as their livelihood. And historically, anybody who was taking any antidepressants would not be able to fly for a minimum of 6 months. In fact, my recollection is there was a period of time, if you go back certainly 20 years, where if you were taking any antidepressant, you could not fly at all, period. And so this led to, you know, two different things. One, pilots not getting the treatment they need, and pilots getting the treatment and not reporting it. And so historically, there's been a real problem at the FAA in how to, you know, work with pilots on these kinds of issues. So the FAA appointed a panel back in December, I believe, and that panel worked really quickly and 90 days later has issued their final report. They have a list of, it's around 26 recommendations. I think I'll have to pull it up, but it's something like that. And this particular article that comes from Yahoo.com highlights just one of the recommendations, probably one of the main ones, which is that the FAA should now basically allow pilots to do so-called talk therapy. That is where you're working with a therapist, but not getting medication, to not have to disclose that you're having that particular therapy. Right now, talk therapy sessions have to be disclosed when you apply for your medical. And I guess the FAA feels that this is a barrier to pilots either reporting it or, you know, pilots getting help. And it sounds like there may be some type of amnesty period. I hate to use that word, where the FAA may let pilots kind of catch up on their reporting of things that they should have reported in the past, but won't need to in the future. But I think this is a great first step. I think there's still a much larger issue, and that's to do with medications, the various kinds of antidepressant medications. These days, there are some which are approved, where in the past there were none that were approved. So pilots can fly on certain antidepressants that are specified by the FAA. My recollection is when pilots start taking them, they have to wait 6 months before they can fly again because of this long evaluation period. And again, that's a huge problem for someone whose livelihood is depending upon flying. This report recommends that waiting period be dropped to 2 months, which makes a lot of sense to me. So it's kind of interesting because the FAA also had a committee that came out with their report just probably a few weeks ago, which was all associated with Boeing. So it seems to me that the FAA has been very good in recent months about establishing working groups on difficult issues they're facing and getting them to give reports pretty quickly. So I like that. That to me bodes well for the direction of the FAA.
Max, you're going to bleep out that word, right?
I heard it. I heard the B word.
Okay. Just bleep it out.
I'm keeping tabs. I'm keeping track. So the FAA is reviewing the recommendations from this expert panel. What do they have to do, or what would they have to do to implement any of the recommendations? Do we expect to see an NPRM? I mean, is it a regulatory change, or is it a policy change, or do you know what it would take to make any of these recommendations actually happen?
It's a good question. I don't know. My guess is some things that they could do with a stroke of a pen. Other things they probably will need some type of NPRM, notice of proposed rulemaking. Hmm. For sure, the guidance to AMEs would have to change. And that's the AMEs, the aviation medical examiners, who are not FAA employees, but are doctors who work on behalf of the FAA for examining pilots. They've got a very thick document of all the things that they are required to do, and that would have to be updated.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, it's kind of a dilemma in a way. I mean, you need to balance the objective of making sure that the pilots are fit for flying, but you don't want to create, which I think we have, a situation or an environment where, as you said, Max, at the beginning of this, that people are either not getting what they need or they are getting it and they're not reporting it. That balance is kind of tough.
Part of it. Go ahead, Max.
One of the things that the report said was that they had identified a number of factors that hinder pilots from disclosing or hinder the FAA from developing recommendations. And those barriers, they came up with seven broad categories: culture, trust, fear, stigma, financial, which would be the cost of getting the therapy, process, knowledge, and information gaps. So there are a lot of barriers to fixing this problem. Hmm.
I was going to say part of the difficulty is that physical fitness or health is typically, not always, but typically more objective to measure than is mental fitness or health.
Good point.
And because of the subjectivity of mental health, it is far more difficult to measure and make decisions based on the ability of a healthy individual that is safe to fly. So the FAA has been making the decision that we're not going to allow anyone with potential mental health problems to fly at all. And now they're looking at that and trying to be able to make a determination as to what can be quantified more regularly and more easily to make a more objective measurement out of something that is typically quite subjective.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the focus was increased on this first after the German Wings accident back in, I believe, 2015, where the suicidal pilot drove the airliner into the ground. And certainly the Alaska incident, not the door plug, but the one before that with the jump seat pilot who reached up and was going to shut off the engines. These kinds of things, I think, have kind of accelerated the whole process of looking at that, because we just can't afford to have, you know, pilots in the cockpit who are having severe issues of any kind.
Yeah. And of course, another thing you don't want to see is pilots with no cockpit to sit in. And United Airlines is facing this right now.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting story. United is, and let's go to the backdrop here. It was only a very few months ago, and I'm literally talking about a handful of months, where all the airlines were trying to find pilots everywhere they could because they were short of pilots. And I think we mentioned just a few weeks ago that United had announced they would be slowing down. Well, they've gone one step further than that. They're now asking pilots to take time off in May because of a shortage of new aircraft. So in other words, they have scheduled more flights than they have planes to fly. And so now they're asking their pilots to take short-term leaves and unpaid time off. Now, these are not these are not mandatory. They're all voluntary. But the gap to me was fascinating. A month ago, United said that it was contractually due 191 new airplanes this year, and they're only going to get 88. So that's a shortfall of more than 100 airplanes this year. And then for next year, they have 127 that are due in, but only 64 are going to arrive. And if you think about the standard number of pilots that you need to staff a new aircraft, depending on the airline and the routes and stuff like that, you're looking at anywhere from 8 to 12 pilots. So if you're 100 new airplanes short, well, 100 times 12, you're looking at 1,200 pilots that you don't need. So suddenly that pilot shortage that we've been talking about, and which has, I think, been real for a couple of years, it's disappearing rapidly for a variety of reasons, including a shortage of new aircraft being delivered on time.
And we know, we don't have to get into the details, but we know what some of the problems are. There's production issues. There's also the issues of an airplane not receiving certification yet that the airline had been planning on, which I think that's maybe kind of a new type of risk for an airline, I, at least in terms of the certification issue. And, if the plane isn't certified, then you're not going to be taking deliveries. And it's tough to forecast or predict how that might change, when that might occur, or when certification may take place. You don't want to overreact to it. You don't want to react too soon to it, only to find out that that was, unnecessary. But I think United Airlines, anyway, has reached the point where they've got to do something. So while this article is talking about taking time off in May of this year, there's some indication that this may also proceed throughout the summer and maybe even into the autumn later on this year. So curious to see how many pilots take up the offer, if you can call it an offer. It's not really an offer, right? They're not getting anything for volunteering to stay home.
It says that it's short-term leave and it's unpaid time off, but it's not mandatory, according to ALPA, yet. ALPA didn't say yet. I said yet.
All right. So Frontier Airlines also in the news, And we see a press release from Frontier that, well, it's kind of an interesting press release, Max.
Yeah, this comes straight from the Frontier Airlines website. And, of course, we think of them as traditionally kind of a low-fare carrier here in the U.S., flying mostly domestic routes. But this is kind of a surprising announcement that came out today. It says that they're going to be adding a wide-body aircraft to their fleet beginning in June that's going to offer lie-flat seating. They're going to have a chef-curated in-flight menu. My mouth is actually watering right now. I think that sounds delicious. Free Wi-Fi for all passengers. That's going to be expensive when it's overseas. And to kick off the new long-haul service, they're going to be doing twice-weekly flights from JFK to, get this, Bora Bora, French Polynesia.
Wow.
So I would love to be on that inaugural flight. And to celebrate the new service, they're offering a one-day-only fare sale for $1, $1. Now, the flights have to be booked by midnight tonight on the day we're recording this. Is that right? Yeah, exactly. So we're recording this on Monday. So by the time you hear this, unfortunately, the sale will be over. But they also say they're holding a random drawing for 100 lucky winners who will receive an all-expense-paid trip for the winner, plus three friends to Bora Bora. And the first 10,000 individuals who sign up for the Frontier Miles Frequent Flyer program will be entered to win. So, I mean, this is absolutely amazing. I mean, who would think that a low-cost carrier would make a huge jump like this? What do you think about this?
I don't know. It was I was kind of shocked.
Well, should I mention that this press release is dated April 1st, 2024?
I did notice that.
Yeah. Those wily guys. It's not true, but it's fascinating that the company would actually put this out. This is on their company website. And if you go partway down the page, there's an asterisk that says about the promotional fare offer, April Fools, we aren't really going to add wide-body aircraft to our fleet or lie-flat seating or shelf-created menu or free Wi-Fi or fly to Bora Bora. However, we're offering a one-day sale featuring flights for low as $38 on they give several routes that they're talking about. So interesting thing. I think that I see fewer and fewer corporate April Fool's kinds of jokes like this. So it's fascinating to see that they use this.
I was going to say that one of the things I loved about it is that do you know if you before you read it, did you know what the airport code for Bora Bora was?
Oh, no.
It's Bob. B.O.B. We're flying to Bob.
I just love it that an airline or any corporation like this has a sense of humor still these days.
We need it, don't we?
We do. We do. So, yeah. Way to go, Frontier.
Exactly. Good on them.
Frontier always had a great sense of humor. Do you remember the, you know, they have animals on the tails of all their aircraft. Do you remember the commercials that they did for the interviews with the animals and to get the new animal?
Among my favorite commercials of all time for any company. I absolutely love the talking animals on the tails of the aircraft. That was just the most creative advertising campaign.
I'm putting the link to one of the YouTube, the first part one of that in the show notes, and we will have it there because if you haven't seen it, you've got to watch it.
Cool.
It says Frontier, low fares done right, and I think they did well today. So good job, Frontier.
All right, what's up with the geeks? We're going to start with David Vanderhoof. David, what's going on over at the museum?
I'm getting involved with Snoopy.
Snoopy?
This year, we'll be celebrating the 55th anniversary of the first Apollo lunar landing, Apollo 11. And we purchased the license and the program for from the Charles Schulz Museum of Snoopy and Space, where Snoopy in Space. We will be transforming the museum into a doghouse full of Snoopy and Charlie Brown and all of the roles that Snoopy has played with NASA. In simple terms, after Apollo 1, where we lost the three astronauts in the test, Charles Schulz and NASA came together that they would use Snoopy as a way of promoting space. And Snoopy has been a icon of safety regulation throughout the whole, all of the Apollo program. In fact, Apollo 10, its command module was Charlie Brown. Its lunar module was Snoopy. Snoopy has flown aboard the shuttle. And the last Artemis mission that occurred last fall, Snoopy actually was aboard the Artemis mission that flew, orbited the Earth as the ZGI, or zero gravity indicator. So there was a Snoopy was aboard the ship, and that's how they could tell they were in space and weightless. But he's been an important asset through the whole program. And besides that, we will be doing rockets and rotors, which is helicopters have been a huge aspect of the space program. And most people are familiar with old 66 hovering over the Apollo and Mercury and Gemini capsules, recovering the astronauts. And we will be using helicopters again to recover astronauts, because we're going back to splashdown, as well as other various aspects. And of course, we can't forget the most important helicopter on another planet, and that's Ingenuity. So all of that ties together, and that's what I've been working on. That will open up on May 25th.
Yeah, it had me going for a minute, David. I was hoping you, when you said rockets and rotors, you were going to do a piece on rocket-tipped rotored helicopters like the Ferry Rotordyne and a few of the others that had ramjets.
Well, there were no rocket-tipped rotors. There were jet-powered rotors.
That's right.
But they were not rocket-tipped. And we do an exhibit already on the Jin, which we actually have a copy of, which was air-pumped through the rotors. Those tip rotors, jet-tipped rotors, are interesting because they don't have any torque, because they don't have an engine developing a shaft. So it's one way to avoid torque, so you don't need a tail rotor or multiple rotors. So we have a Jin as an example. The Rotordyne was actually not a helicopter. It was, in fact, an autogyro that had but there have been other helicopters that have used tip jets to propel the rotors to act as a helicopter.
So did those tip jets produce power at the chip, at the tips, or is it like central and pumped through the
The engine? For example, the Jin, which we have in which was a small French helicopter, air is developed, the jet thrust is developed at an engine at the center of the fuselage. And then the air is pumped up through the fuselage, up to the rotors, and out to the tips.
Ah, okay. That makes more sense. So is that method still in use?
It comes and goes. It's never taken to the point where it's been successful and mass produced.
And they're very, very loud.
They are.
The Ferry Rotordyne, which, as David said, it wasn't a helicopter, but I think it had ramjets at the tips.
Interesting. So when does this program? You said May 25th, David, right?
Yep, absolutely.
At the American Helicopter Museum.
Worry about it later.
Excellent. Micah, what have you been up to?
It's been a quiet week. We've got a new Journey is a Reward podcast that came out today as we record this. It's not an April Fool's joke. It's episode 68 with Brian's high school friend, Chef Kathy, who is a U2 stalker. It's her third time on the show. She was a lot of fun. She went to U2, went to Ireland to take pictures in front of Bono's house. She went to Las Vegas, and this was a second show where she went to see U2 with another high school friend of Brian's, and she went back, but it must be contagious because Brian ended up going to Las Vegas to see U2 in the Sphere, and that's a good portion of what we talk about. And I think I'm immune because I have no desire to go to Las Vegas or see U2, but nonetheless.
Not even to see the Sphere, huh?
Not really, no.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, that episode is out, and give it a listen. Kathy's a lot of fun, She's a great chef.
And we can find that at thejourneyistthereward.org. Okay. And Max Trescott, anything? I almost missed you, didn't I? Anything going on? Thank you, Micah. Anything going on in your world?
Well, I'm just back from 2 weeks at University of Southern California. The aviation program in their engineering department, the first week I took a course on human factors, and the second week was the helicopter accident investigation course. The joke I keep telling everyone is the thing I learned in the second week is I shouldn't be flying helicopters, which really is a joke. I mean, their accident rate is not significantly different from the fixed wing rate. But one of the concepts that came out in the human factors course, which I really liked, at the end of the week, they asked us to build an accident. And by what they meant was to take data and information you have about your particular organization and essentially predict what the next accident might be. And I thought that was an incredibly useful concept. And I penned out something, you know, really quickly for the flying club that I fly with in Palo Alto. And I said the next accident would be probably a pilot with less than 250 hours taking off from Truckee Airport that night, dark night, no moon. May have topped off the tank, so they were max gross weight, and unfortunately would end up with a collision into terrain or possibly, you know, go into IMC. And then this past weekend on Saturday, sure enough, there was another fatal accident at Truckee. Fortunately, not from my club, but very tragic, very capable aircraft. It was a TBM 960, which is their latest model, and it had been delivered just 15 months ago to a pilot who had prior experience in the TBM before he bought this one. And so we'll be talking about that this coming week on Aviation News Talk. And there are a couple of things that are pretty clear from looking at it that the pilot could have done differently. But essentially, it was very poor weather at the time going into Truckee and you know, a number of other factors. So we'll be talking about that in detail on episode, 322. I can't remember now. The numbers keep increasing every week.
Yeah, funny how that happens. So the TBM 960, that's a turboprop, correct?
It is a very capable machine. It's got, you know, flies about 330 knots or so. It has pretty long range, somewhere on the order of 1,700 miles. And this particular one was being flown by the owner. His wife was the passenger, and they were coming from Centennial Airport, just south of Denver, to Truckee, which was their home airport. And actually, that's episode 322. I just looked it up.
One item from listener mail. You may recall back in episode 790, we received an email from a listener. He said he was an avid listener, lives in Texas. Father started flight training, now working up the ratings. He wants to be a part of the aviation community and was asking us about a roadmap for the best way to start flying. We had some thoughts, but we concluded that a little more information would be helpful in terms of giving advice. And so we heard back from him, and he did provide some additional information. He said that he would not really like to be in the military, and that's fine. And then this one, which I think is very key, he said he's 12 years old, which I hadn't envisioned someone that young. He's been flying with his father a number of times. He would like to be an aerospace engineer. He's particularly looking for general aviation flying, GA flying. And so a little bit more information from him. But yeah, Max, he's only 12 years old. That's pretty, this kid has got, he's looking to the future.
Well, certainly I think that's the time when the bug bites people. He talks about aviation being kind of addictive. And yes, you're right. So that's certainly the time frame where I became very interested in aviation. I started taking lessons when I was 15. That's a good age to take lessons because you can solo when you're 16. One thing you might consider if you want to start doing it a little earlier is just doing some glider training. My recollection, you can solo a glider at 14. Does that sound familiar?
That's right. Riley Spiedel.
Yep. So that's one option. He might just consider doing some glider training. And frankly, most of the glider training is going to be directly applicable to flying a GA aircraft. So that would be a great way to actually get some flying time in early. And you might just go ahead and start doing some online study. For example, there are some great online courses available from folks like Sporties and King Schools. And yeah, these are in the ballpark of $250, and they'll have on the order of, well, say 25, maybe 30 hours of videos. And that's just going to give you a lot of background information that you need about aviation as well. So that's a great way to kind of sink your teeth into it is, you know, start learning some of the academics. And then in terms of learning to fly, if your father has already started flight training, then you probably already know where he's learning to fly and who his flight instructor is. You know, it seems like it would be logical to start there. 12 would probably be a little on the early side for that. But let me phrase it this way. If one had, let me just think about how to phrase that. If you start taking flying lessons when you're 12, it's going to be more expensive because by the time you get done, you're going to have far more hours accumulated and hence have spent far more money than if you were to start when you were, say, 15, because you can complete the training faster, fewer hours. Otherwise, you're just kind of, you're getting some experience, but you'll be getting that same experience over and over again, and that just becomes more expensive. So if you've got the money, sure, you could start doing that immediately. If money is a bit of an issue, which it often is for folks, then you might just wait till you're a little bit older. And one key recommendation I've seen, which makes a lot of sense, is that if money is an issue, wait until you have most, if not all, the money saved up that you need for training. An incredibly inefficient, expensive way to get a license is to start when you don't have as much money, because then you're going to be starting and stopping and wait for some more money and then starting and stopping. And that's going to give you far more total hours and far greater cost as well.
Wow.
And, you know, remember a couple of weeks ago when Colonel Erin Dick was with us and she told us how she learned to fly? She found somebody that needed some help with the plane and keeping it clean. And she found someone that was willing to teach her and let her fly and work with her. And that's always, I'm sure you can find somebody at the airport that would help you with that. This is one of those times where I really miss Launchpad because he's in Texas and Launchpad was in Texas. And just knowing him, it doesn't matter where he was in Texas. Launchpad would have flown over there, took him for a flight and took him under his wing. And I can just see the smile on both of their faces together.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Max.
No, you go ahead.
Then the other thing, you know, he said he'd like to be an aerospace engineer. And I did a little bit of looking. And back in 2022, Flying Magazine did an article titled See Where the Top Aviation Universities Rank. And it's a good list. It explains some things. And, you know, if you want to be an aerospace engineer, you're going to have to go to some school someplace. So you might as well take a look there and see what you can get yourself into and maybe put it all together into learning to fly and getting your degree.
And I was surprised to learn years ago that Embry-Riddle, as I recall, has one of the top aerospace engineering programs in the country. I always historically thought of them as producing pilots, but no, they actually have a very large aerospace engineering program. So that's certainly an option as well. But yeah, I mean, look at universities that have aerospace engineering degrees. I would, focus on looking for, you know, a school with a good engineering program, not necessarily a university that's geared toward producing pilots. Now, it turns out that you've got the best of both of those at Embry-Riddle. But, you know, historically, the aviation-oriented schools that turn out pilots are not always the schools that turn out aerospace engineers. So pick your university for a good aerospace engineering program. And then look at flying, I think, is kind of a fun thing to do on the side, which I will say is kind of what I did. I went to get my degree in electrical engineering. I started to fly as a teenager, and I thought that it would always be just a fun avocation that I would use as a hobby on the side for the rest of my life. Lo and behold, after 25 years of working at Hewlett Packard, they decided to lay me off, which I was grateful for because, man, I was done. And fortunately, I had gotten my CFI certificate about 3 years prior to that. And so it was pretty easy to roll into this as a second career. So you never know. It's just kind of fun to have aviation in your hip pocket because you might actually turn it into a career at some point.
All great advice. So to our 12-year-old listener, well, first of all, thank you for listening to us. But stay in touch, you know, kind of let us know how you make out. If you encounter some other advice or from others or decide to execute the advice in an interesting way, just, you know, let us know. Keep us in the loop.
And if you do have that advice, you know, we would love to hear from you in an audio recording. Don't just write us, but tell us so we could play it for our listeners as well, because they want to hear you too.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think when we played the last listener recording an episode or two ago, and we did get some really nice positive feedback on that, I think Rob mentioned that, you know, we'd love to hear your recorded stories. And maybe we didn't emphasize that enough, but we really do like to get recorded messages, feedback, stories, you know, any of the above from you. And it's very simple, actually, to produce a recording like that. Just every smartphone, every phone has got some kind of an audio app, voice memo app or something similar. And if not, you can easily get one. And you can just record on that. And then send that to us, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And you don't have to worry too much about trying to sound great because we can do a lot of magic things to, you know, help make you sound fantastic, something that we've learned to do since 2008.
Yeah, I mean, look what Max did for me.
That's right. That's right. So don't be too concerned about that. Just think about, you know, the message and what is the message that you'd like to communicate to us. And we really do enjoy getting those.
And try to do it in a quiet environment. That's the only other thing that makes sense. A lot of background noise isn't going to help.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, don't do it in your bathroom or the kitchen or someplace like
that. Or the car.
Well, the car can be not a bad place. Yeah.
Well, if the engine's not running.
Oh, yeah. Yes. You could use your car as a sound booth with the engine off. Closets are also very excellent places to record things. So you can find us, of course, at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for every episode are there, including this one. Obviously, we have links to all the stories that we talk about and some other resources that come up along the way. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we'll start with you, Micah. If people want to get in touch with you, where do they find you?
Well, I'm still on Twitter, no matter what you want to call it, and I'm at MaineFly, M-A-I-N-E like the state, F-L-Y, let's go fly. And I did get somebody that wrote to me through Twitter last week, and I thank you very much for the feedback. It was very helpful. And then you can always find me with Brian Coleman, our former associate producer and very good friend, on the Journey is the Reward podcast.
Yeah, check that out if you haven't. It's a great podcast, and Micah and Brian make a great team. Very enjoyable and entertaining. All right, David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
You could find me at the American Helicopter Museum, or you can find me online if you can spell Vanderhoof.
All right. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, the usual place, head on out to aviationnewstalk.com or search for Aviation News Talk on your podcast player. And if you go to the website, you'll find a contact form at the top of the page.
Terrific. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Mastodon, also on our Slack listener team and our Discord server. If you'd like to get into either of those, just write us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com and we'll tell you how to get in. All right. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
See you real soon.
And thanks for listening.
Bye, everybody.